to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Delighted to introduce Joe today. Joe is he's a person that we should have had here many, many years ago. He's an intellectual ally of the Berkman Center in many, many ways and has covered a lot of terrain that we find really, really interesting and fascinating. He's done a lot of work on intellectual property rights, open source, data availability, and things of that ilk. He is from the Social Sciences Research Council. He runs a couple programs there that I'll have to read, otherwise I'll get them terribly wrong. One of them is Necessary Knowledge for a Democratic Public Sphere. Another one is Culture, Creativity, and Information Technology. What Joe is going to talk about today is a study looking at media piracy around the world. He's delving into an area which is subject to a lot of bluster and noise, and is doing something which we find really, really interesting and important, which is to go and take an empirical look at that. And I guess we're going to find out shortly whether he thinks that was a good idea or not. But, jump in. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I've followed Berkman very closely for lots of reasons over the last few years. It's a pleasure and an honor to finally come and present some of this work to you. What we've done over the last 3 years is conduct what has turned into a six-country study of media piracy. And by media, I mean primarily music, film, and software. It's a very large project. It's become rather encyclopedic in its breadth. I won't try and present it in any detail, but I will try to hit some of the main points very briefly, and then we can come back to them in conversation as they strike a chord. These are the primary partners in the project. We've had four primary country reports and several other contributions from independent scholars. SSRC has been sort of at the center as a coordinating body and responsible for some of the overview of the policy arena and some of the questions about how research is produced and how it affects the policy-making process. The work is just wrapping up after 3 years. I'd hoped that this would be a post-launch presentation, but it unfortunately is still a pre-launch presentation. Hopefully we'll have a final version of the report available in March. And there will be a launch. It'll be a fairly visible document. If you're interested in seeing it, you'll have plenty of opportunities. Just to give you a brief background, a bit of background on where the project comes from. We started planning it really in 2004 at the kind of intersection of projects about changes in cultural production and conversations about access to knowledge, which were just beginning to come together in 2004-2005. The elephant in the room, we thought at the time, and I think is still the case to a considerable extent, was piracy, where projects of reform of access to knowledge, projects to increase access to knowledge of different types of media, did so really in a state of kind of deliberate avoidance of the elephant in the room, which was media piracy. Access to recorded media was and still is, to a considerable extent, the primary form of access in developing countries. The digital media economy is still, to a large extent, a pirate media economy, despite the rise of some low-cost alternatives in high-income countries. The industry talked about these things constantly, and they were, and still are, engines of anti-piracy discourse and research on piracy, to an extent that just hasn't been replicated in the academy or on the part of the sort of pro-reform, progressive IP community. Nobody in that community, when we started this project, was talking about piracy, which I found surprising, and eventually ended up attributing to the dominance of lawyers in this sort of progressive IP discourse, where the boundaries of the discourse were always about the clarification of, or extension of, the rule of law. And piracy was just a problem, a phenomenon that just fell outside those kinds of disciplinary proclivities. So we saw a role for a kind of broader social scientific approach to these questions. We also saw a political necessity in doing so, in that it was clear that the debate had begun to shift from a focus on higher formal IP protection to a debate about higher enforcement practices or stronger enforcement practices. You know, the point of diminishing returns had been passed with respect to stronger IP law. Life plus 90 copyright terms offers very little additional revenue opportunities over life plus 70. In contrast, reducing piracy from 90 to 80% in China is a very large potential source of additional revenue. So we saw the enforcement debate beginning to take over the IP debate, and increasingly being used to apply pressure to countries to adopt enforcement as a higher priority for the allocation of limited social resources, to reorganize judicial systems and policing in the service of IP enforcement. Much of this was, of course, on behalf of U.S. companies, and through the mechanism of the USTR and USTR pressure on other countries. Increasingly, and in some of the most interesting cases, it was also coming out of domestic copyright industries that had begun to grow in places like India and Brazil. So we began to sort of frame a project that would ask a different set of questions, and different, primarily, or at least initially, with respect to the way the industry was posing some of the some of its investigations into piracy. We wanted to look not just at the costs of piracy to rights holders, but also the obvious material benefits of certain kinds of piracy in developing countries. And these begin to get very complex, but it was precisely that complexity that we thought was had dropped out of the debate about enforcement. We began to look at the role of industry research in policymaking, and some of this reflected early efforts to examine industry research, and as I'm sure you're all familiar with, there is now a kind of cottage industry in debunking industry-produced piracy research or copyright research. A lot of it, the ease with which industry numbers were debunked or shown to be unsourced or invented was really something that motivated us at the outset, and to some extent dropped away as the work continued and more people began to participate in this kind of collective skeptical, largely online community of IP activism. We were very interested in the question of how different industries manage their exposure to piracy. I mean, part of the problem, too, was the very deliberate conflation of different sectors of the same industry and different industries into a kind of universal rights holder community that faced a uniform threat from piracy. This obviously made no sense. If you begin to look at individual industries, the problems facing the record companies, the movie companies, the software companies, different sectors within the software industry are really very different. Tended to be driven by the highest level of threat, which, of course, at the outset these debates in the early 2000s was the record companies. Across a pretty wide range of issues, we've tried to disaggregate those questions of exposure, disaggregate questions of piracy from counterfeiting. Piracy and counterfeiting used to belong to really the same sphere of production and distribution. They're still used in the same, often piracy and counterfeiting are part of the same phrase in policy conversations. When the OECD looks at the subject, they take up piracy and counterfeiting. They're always together. They have less and less to do with each other in actual practice. What we see is increasingly strategic use of the two in order to kind of level up the harms attributed to media piracy with the very clear harms, public health problems, defective goods, and the range of rather serious problems associated with counterfeiting. part of the work tries to sort of pry those questions apart. I won't, you know, I won't do much more to kind of lay out the project in its entirety, but I do want to just kind of briefly run through three fairly important contributions in the report on pricing, structure, policymaking, and the organization of enforcement. With respect to pricing, I'm talking primarily about the persistence of high and relatively uniform media prices in the developing world, reflecting what we've fairly clearly mapped out as industry strategies to prioritize the protection of high-value Western markets over serving broader populations in developing markets. So this is why when you buy a copy of Microsoft Office, it's still $300 where, you know, in India and in Russia, in South Africa. Pricing of DVDs in the movie industry is very uniform. Price of CDs shows a bit more variation because of the complexity of how pricing is negotiated between record companies and retailers, but still relatively little variation. High prices, ubiquitous digital technologies, and low incomes are pretty much the recipe for digital piracy. And piracy is ubiquitous wherever those conditions are ubiquitous. So that was sort of the first takeaway, and it becomes immediately apparent when you start looking at prices relative to local incomes, the prices of goods. The structure of policymaking, I'll say a few words about the relationship between industry groups, the IIPA and the USTR. If you don't know who that refers to, the industry groups are the industry associations like the MPA, the RIAA, the BSA, Business Software Alliance, the representatives of the different copyright industries. And they're kind of their umbrella organization for certain purposes, the IIPA, the International Intellectual Property Alliance. The IIPA, the IIPA's primary role is to take industry reporting on piracy and to filter it into the USTR, the U.S. Trade Representatives. The IIPA and the USTR are, in some respects, kind of binary single entity, where the IIPA is the kind of research wing and the USTR is the policy wing, and the two have been you know, very closely related since their inception. IIPA was founded in 1984. The Special 301 process of the USTR, which is the relevant process for intellectual property negotiations, was created in 1988. And that relationship is really what initiated this very substantial industry investment in research. So the USTR Special 301 process was created in order to give industry an opportunity to complain about the IP practices of other countries and to create a mechanism for doing that. And it also set up evidentiary requirements that had to be met in order to pursue the complaint process. It created an immediate demand for a kind of global research into enforcement and IP practices that just didn't exist before. The IIPA was a new organization in 1984. By the early 90s, it had dramatically ramped up, and its partnering organizations had dramatically ramped up their reporting processes. So suddenly, you had parallel studies underway in dozens of countries every year, reporting on the existing state of IP law, the desired state according to the industries, enforcement practices, failures of enforcement, and the general politics around how you strengthen enforcement practices. And these really set the discursive terms for the piracy debate. When people hear the word piracy, it's, of course, a very loaded term. It's loaded because it's a product of this industry-driven enforcement discourse. So we debated for quite some time whether we wanted to continue to use the term, and there are obvious pros and cons, or cons, at least. But we didn't want to give up the discursive terrain, in effect, because that's, you know, it's the locus communis of this conversation, and it's not something that the industry reporting owns in any clear respect. There are processes of discursive reinvention and drift underway that we thought we could take advantage of, and begin to reintroduce some complexity into this thing that people characterize as piracy. Now, the third point on the organization of enforcement, just to preview, it's simply a question of what happens when scarce enforcement resources meet ubiquitous, ubiquitous piracy, ubiquitous illegal activity. And this gives rise to all kinds of sort of perverse outcomes and problems that I'll outline in a little bit more detail. So I just want to highlight some of the pricing that this is really just kind of a gimmick. We collected some pricing information. We translated it. We collected information on legal prices, on the pirate pirate prices. Usually, pirate prices in a given country are there's a kind of range of pricing depending on where you're buying the good. At the high end, it's almost always in central public markets that target tourists. At the low end, it's the guy in a low income or lowest income neighborhood who's just sort of reselling things that he burns in his home. And then we translated them into what we call the comparative purchasing price, which is the price that it represents the price in if the price in the percentage of GDP per capita and applying it to the U.S. context. So if the price in the U.S. represented the same percentage of GDP, a $20 South African CD is $170 in the U.S. if it represented the same percentage of GDP. So you end up with some very extreme pricing differences between local prices and local incomes. And if you look at the pirate pricing, I mean, we generally took pirate CPP as representing the upper range. But at the upper range, you're dealing with relative prices relative to local incomes that are not too dissimilar from the legal prices in Western countries. They're in the same order of magnitude. So you begin to see how the pirate market serves local populations. It's something closer to what would be considered affordable in U.S. or European countries, and how the legal market doesn't do that at all. The legal market's serving a tiny fraction of the population. This is, incidentally, the pricing for Coldplay's Viva La Vida hit album from 2008. You see that pricing is fairly uniformly high, I mean, at or around U.S. pricing, with the exception of India. Dark Knight DVD shows you see very little variation, or if there is variation, it tends to be variation up, as in Mexico. The movie companies exercise much more control over pricing in other countries than the record companies, and they maintain pretty consistently high levels of pricing. If you look at domestically produced albums, you see a bit more variation, in part because the local record producers don't insist on high levels of return. They don't insist on Western levels of return on their investment when marketing the album, and they place a much higher value on the cultivation of local audiences. So in many cases, prices will tend to be somewhat lower for domestically produced albums, even when they're controlled by the big multinationals, as most of them are. Domestically produced films, here, again, the influence of the major studios is the primary determinant. Very few countries, even when talking about local film industries, very few of those film industries control enough of the production and distribution chain to have much influence over pricing. So if you're looking at Mexican film or South African film or Russian film, they're all going to be pricing comparable to the major studios. The big exceptions to this are in the countries where there's a substantial local industry that really does control the distribution chain. And in several cases, they've begun to compete with pirates. They've begun to compete with the pirate prices. So you see this in India, where companies like Moser have dramatically undercut the standard pricing for home video, for DVDs. You may or may not be familiar with the Nigerian model, the Nigerian film industry. In terms of number of films, I think it's the largest industry at this point. In terms of revenues, it's third after the US and India. It's primarily a home video industry. There's very little theatrical distribution in Nigeria, but the home distribution is very deliberately priced at a level to reach a mass audience and to do so via the channels that people have actually have access to on the street. The legitimate distributors sell street vendors. Street vendors become the retail outlet for Nigerian film. So I just want to point out something else about pricing. One of the main drivers of changes in the organization of the pirate economy has been the collapse in pricing over the last 10 years. 10 years ago, if you were buying a DVD on the street or some of the early DVDs or CDs, prices would have been uniformly in the $5 or over range. It was really still an industrial economy in which production facilities were fairly scarce. They tended to be quite fairly concentrated in a few countries, so you had rather complex international networks of smuggling and transshipment and relations with organized crime because they were the same networks that shipped other kinds of counterfeit and contraband goods. It was a fairly high profit business. That's no longer the case. Prices in most countries have collapsed very close to marginal price, and that marginal price, if you're looking from the kind of raw CD to the minimal chain through producer and distributor, gets as low as 40 cents for a DVD. As I said, there's a lot of difference in the scope of pricing even within a particular city, where tourist markets will be selling at higher prices, $2, $3 a CD. Local markets catering to working class people or to the rural poor will be much closer to that 40 cent per disc level. And this is how the optical disc economy ends, in a nutshell. It's clearly giving way to there's massive competition within the optical disc pirate production community within these countries because of the explosion in productive capacity, because burners and the raw materials are so cheap. It's being displaced by non-commercial pirate distribution via internet and other sources. And in all the countries we've looked at, this transition is underway. And if you're looking for optical discs on the street in the U.S. or Europe, basically it's gone. I mean, it's moved entirely to a digital distribution model. Not true in most of the developing countries we've looked at, where the infrastructure for online distribution for sort of the trading and sharing of digital formats is still quite limited. The optical disc economy is still very large and important and present in daily life because of earlier moments of technological diffusion where cheap CD players flowed into most of these countries in the late 1990s. Cheap DVD players followed a few years later. Those DVD players are now the center of gravity for the media infrastructure in many of these countries. But most of them also enable playback of MP4 files of other kinds of formats that are setting up the next wave of digital distribution. Broadband penetration in many of these countries is exploding and while not reaching U.S. levels, the growth from sort of 0 to 20% penetration is astonishingly fast. I think I left out the slide that shows some of that, but the digital transition happens very quickly once the right regulatory and sort of technical infrastructures are in place. So our study is really about this transitional moment in these economies between the optical disc and the purely digital. To touch briefly on the structure of policymaking. So as I was saying, the IPA and USTR are on the copyright side of the question are really these sort of paired institutions where the IAPA provides the research inputs into USTR, drawing on its industry association membership, which are in turn drawing on the major media companies. USTR applies the pressure to individual country governments, and behind those governments are local representatives of those multinational industry associations who are lobbying from the domestic side too and increasingly incorporating domestic copyright industries. IIPA submits annual reports that list countries for inclusion on the watch lists, on the priority watch lists. The Special 301 process has all these categories for different levels of surveillance and warning. USTR passes them through 85% of the time. It's basically a pass-through for IIPA requests on the copyright side. You may or may not be familiar with this chart. This is kind of the money shot from the IIPA reports, listing various attributed levels of industry losses, losses to U.S. industries, and rates. Losses and rates are the coins of the realm for industry reporting. We have quite a bit of work unpacking what this means and how the industry groups calculate rates of piracy and what the integrity of the different methods are. As I was telling Rob earlier, we were influenced at the outset of this work by the appearance of lack of integrity of a lot of these research results. My sense of this has become a lot more, I think, nuanced in the course of talking to industry people and really trying to piece together what the industry is doing. And in the report, I characterize it as something what has become over time a more sophisticated and interesting and in the aggregate improving set of research methods that's still tied to an advocacy and lobbying campaign that just plays very loose with facts and evidence. So part of the intent of the report is to try and tease out a distinction between the two and encourage the research side, because the industry devotes vastly more attention and resources to these questions than anybody else, and that's a very valuable longitudinal record for mapping these practices. So there's good work there. Research standards have risen, and the researchers themselves want to see more public disclosure of what they're doing, of their methods, and that's part of the report is trying to encourage that tendency, to let that impulse govern how the discourse is shaped by the industry groups.
Well, is anyone trying to figure out where the U.S. would fit in the hierarchy here?
The IIPA does not do that. Some of the industry groups do.
Right.
The IIPA
is explicitly international.
Yeah. The IIPA is only funneling work into the Special 301 process, so it doesn't look at it only treats countries of interest, right? So there are lots of countries that aren't of interest to the IIPA, but maybe of interest to the record companies or to the BSA. The BSA is very comprehensive in its list of in its reporting.
I'm sorry, what are the levels indicated? What does the 75% mean? Does that mean 75% of all media is pirated?
Yes. No, it's the 75%.
That's
right. The total market, including pirated goods. So, go ahead.
In that everybody who's using a pirate program would have otherwise bought a full price legitimate copy?
No. This gets into a very complicated terrain and one that the groups are not keen to talk about. Some of the information is proprietary. To give you the short answer, the IFPI, which is the other record industry association, the one based in the UK that has the largest international representation, only looks at the street value of pirated goods. So if it says there are 20 million pirated CDs in a country that they're sold in the country in a given year, they're going to value that at the street price, not at the retail price. The ESA has done that with respect to entertainment software. The RIAA takes the same IFPI data and applies some secret sauce to it that allows it to come up with a loss estimate. So it's unclear how the RIAA does this business, does its work. The BSA is the notorious sort of one-to-one correspondence data. They make the strongest claims of pirated losses representing lost retail sales, and as a result, their figures are just an order of magnitude above anybody else's. $53 billion in 2008, as opposed to $5 billion for the last record industry reports. The MPAA, which reported for the last time in 2005, was at $6 billion in direct losses. The discourse about losses is driven by the BSA at this point.
Because they're too small a market yet?
I'm sorry?
E-books are not mentioned here because they're too small.
Yeah, we excluded books. Just they're just not significant in the. I should say piracy of physical books is significant in some countries, but the digital transition is just for the next 5 years, and it's something we'd like to build into a next round of work. But we're not there with this study. So we get into a lot of this sort of methodological terrain in the report, but I don't know, and we can come back to it, but I'll pass over it fairly quickly now.
I don't understand how or why they would keep the recording industry keep their method secret. Is it because they're creating this for internal use, and the people who, there are certain people who think, I mean, it seems like it would be unconvincing to tell people that we're losing this much money, and we're not going to tell you how we figured that out, right?
The default is secrecy. These are consulting
So who are they
units.
Consulting for? So it's not secret to say the USTR, but it
No, they don't provide that information to USTR either. USTR has a requirement that in research submissions you have to describe your methodology.
Right.
That document that the IIPA produces every year is 2 pages long, and provides just the barest sketch of how the industry does its work. The BSA is actually the best of this. I mean, it's a dubious honor. They, you know, their methodology is a three-page document, but still leaves out all the key information that would allow you to reproduce the results. And that's, you know, that is our big bone to pick with all the issues around transparency and the credibility of the reporting process and the credibility of the policymaking process that relies on it. All of this is a black box, and very deliberately so. And the question is, well, why is it a black box, and is it still in the industry's interest that it be a black box? And my argument would be no. The value of their research brand has been so devalued in the last 5 or 6 years that they actually have a compelling interest now to be more forthcoming about their methods and just practice greater disclosure.
Page and three-page documents from the RIAA and BSA available to the public? Could those be hunted down?
If you visit the IIPA site with every annual submission to the Special 301 process, there is a methodology appendix. And then you can usually find a bit more information. The BSA always has a methodology page attached to its piracy reporting because they've taken so much heat for this one-to-one equivalence over the years, with reason. I mean, they've been there. Some the director of the report from 2004 got zinged in the New York Times. He acknowledged that, in his view, it really should have been more like a 1-to-10 substitution ratio, and that if he'd had his way about it, things would have looked rather different. The $27 billion would have just been $2.7 billion, and I think. BSA has been both the most aggressive practitioner of these sorts of inflationary practices of loss, counting up losses, and as a result, the most exposed to criticism, and also, in some respects, the most forthcoming. But the core elements of their methodology are still a black box. I'll just zip past that because it's not where I wanted to spend the most time, but we can come back to it. This is the outcome of the USTR Special 301 process year to year. So the USTR can do three things, basically. It can put you on a watch list, a priority watch list, or a priority foreign country list, which is sort of the prelude to a fast-track sanctions process. And what you see is a dramatic shift in how it made use of those procedures year to year. And the big shift happened around 1994. And in the couple of years in which the implementation of the WTO was a foregone conclusion, it was clear that this largely unilateral process of warning and sanctioning countries was going to have to fit in somehow to this much more explicit multilateral regime. And they didn't quite know what that would entail. But they concluded very early on that it meant that they couldn't initiate sanctions against WTO members, because that would be a potential violation of U.S. requirements under the WTO to pursue any dispute resolution through the multilateral process. So the teeth in the Special 301 process basically fell out in 2004. And all the countries, with I think the exception of Chile in 1 year, all the subsequent sanctions were applied to countries that were outside the WTO at the time. So this is the Ukraine. Ukraine was a gangster state for a number of years, and from the perspective of both the pharmaceutical companies and the copyright companies, just a site of just rampant piracy. Ukraine was the home to many of the optical disc production facilities, initiated under prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but there were a number of places in which these sort of heavy industry, high-tech facilities were relatively well-developed and survived the transition and began to stamp out pirated CDs and DVDs as soon as there was a sufficient market for them. So the USTR, the Special 301 process, really became a warnings regime where the number of warnings sort of was ramped up year to year, and the number of sanctions dropped off the map. And the real question is, in 1999, there was a challenge to whether even the warnings were legal under the WTO, and there was a ruling when the European Commission challenged this, sanctions would be a contravention of the multilateral dispute resolution, but warnings were kind of a dicey area, and it's been left unresolved since then. So the real question is what happens now, and the way that, in our view, the resolution to this uncertainty about the Special 301 process will happen through the ACTA treaty, which is, if you're following sort of IP negotiations, this is sort of the next big deal, the next major treaty that will be devoted to enforcement issues. So ACTA will sort of smooth out all the inconsistencies involved in U.S. Bilateral agreements that create sort of TRIPS plus obligations that go over and above the requirements of the WTO agreements. This is the comment process. I'll skip this just because I'm running behind. But Special 301 process has opened up a little bit in the last 2 years for reasons that are kind of complicated and interesting. And countries have figured this out and have jumped in. So now you have a contested policymaking process where before it was just a complete insider's game, and that's quite interesting. That's something we're trying to take advantage of in the next couple of weeks, actually, since the comment process for 2010 is about to happen. So it's a February deadline. I'll make three quick points about the organization of enforcement, and then just wrap up. One is that when you have scarce enforcement resources targeting ubiquitous pirate practices, you get really four things. You get the emergence of what we describe as a confiscation regime, where the ability to raid and confiscate goods scales up much more easily than due process around prosecutions of alleged pirates. So there are very few prosecutions in any of these countries, but there's a huge number of raids and confiscations. So the raids become the punishment, in effect. And there's no. They don't bother with the due process because it takes so long in many countries, and the civil procedures are very cumbersome. Filing an infringement suit can take years. Filing and prosecuting an infringement suit. So you get a situation where the industry groups have successfully enlisted the police and scaled up their capacities, but have faced serious obstacles on the judicial end. So the number of raids and seizures hugely outweighs the number of prosecutions of success and successful prosecutions, especially. The counterpoint to that is spectacular punishments in the few cases that can be successfully brought to completion. So you've seen that here, obviously. Many countries have analogous examples of these sort of multi-million or even billion-dollar infringement suits or claims of infringement against BitTorrent system administrators, online music sites that aren't adequately licensed under international licensing rules. You get competition for enforcement resources among the companies that that have access to them. So and we found that you know, the big industry associations can generally direct enforcement at every stage. They're so closely woven into the enforcement apparatus that they can, you know, at every step of the process, from identifying suspected pirates to evidence collection to planning the raids to the prosecution of the raids to the funding of the raids, since many of the police forces are underfunded, industry is just, there's just no boundary anymore between public and private power. It's just it's a completely fused enterprise. And that this has competitive uses, so some companies can make more effective use of this than others. It tends to reward companies with influence, and it rewards size, and reinforces both of those things. We found that the company, well, I mean, Microsoft is in a category of its own, and we can come back to that. But domestic companies, and especially film companies, are arguably the most successful at capturing and deploying state enforcement resources, in part because the politics of enforcement on behalf of domestic industries are so much better than conducting massive raid campaigns in order to send additional royalties to Microsoft or Adobe or whatever the foreign company is.
And most of these raids that it involves exact product, like copied one for one, or has that also been used on like sort of parody stuff too?
I'm not sure I follow.
I'm just like, for the confiscation, it's like it's the exact product. Like there's, you know, like down to the hash sums or whatever. So like Warner Brothers with like their Harry Potter stuff. Like there's a comic who is reading an overdub, and they're like, no, you can't do that. So I'm wondering if it's because it's being run by the industry for their own stuff, they're funding it, they're directing it, they're prioritizing different stuff. If this is like just them each going after their own stuff, or if they're just kind of going after like stuff they don't like, which may be their stuff or maybe parodies of their stuff as well. Or do we not?
In that respect, well, there are a couple issues in regard to what gets confiscated. One problem is that it's often impossible to tell what's an infringing good and what isn't. So there are some problems with mass confiscation that end up involving seizure of legitimate property. And this has, in a couple of cases, this has operated as a kind of break on the raid regime. In Russia and South Africa, there've been pushback from businesses when the raids have just gotten out of hand and begun to be a burden on local business. So that happens fairly frequently. With respect to specific cases of creative appropriation, I mean, we're just not operating at that level. Those are sort of case by case. I can't think of an instance in which, you know, the structural structural organization of enforcement would be relevant at the level of a particular type of infringement. But I mean, and let's see. Well, the obvious point is that if you can bring law enforcement resources to bear in protecting your film or your software, then that's a competitive advantage in the marketplace. Other people are less. It's not an even playing field. It can't be an even playing field given the available resources. We found that Bollywood films, for example, are widely pirated, but there's almost no Bollywood enforcement infrastructure outside India. I mean, they're just at the beginning of the process of setting up these sort of international networks that can engage with local police forces. So the reports of very unequal enforcements of different national cinemas is a relevant issue. And then we've seen the emergence of business models based on the kinds of opportunities that these enforcement regimes provide. from the sort of blatantly illegal shakedown variety where you co-opt the police and sick them on your competitors because everybody's operating in the black economy, but you know, the police will can be encouraged to operate selectively in that context. To things like DigiProtect, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but the sort of businesses that are practicing mass surveillance of online piracy and sending out payment notices to I mean it's sort of a short circuiting of the three strikes model where independent operators are conducting surveillance online and demanding money when they detect infringing activity and threatening lawsuits if you don't pay up. So that's a rather controversial.
Do the locals understand that it's illegal, or is it considered sort of like an everyday activity?
Oh, it's every day. And,
but do people comprehend that there's repercussions for this, or is this just expected that everyone buy CDs or DVDs this way?
Everybody buys CDs and DVDs this way. It's understood as both illegal and every day.
Okay.
That's a very clear finding from this.
Know someone who's been reprimanded for this?
Enforcement has. No other countries have targeted consumer-level infringements. They've all been about intermediaries. And that's really where the next couple of years are going to be interesting, because so much of the online enforcement solutions are about shifting that focus to the consumer. But countries simply haven't had the resources or the inclination to pursue enforcement at that level.
The reason I ask is because where I'm from, it's people don't think of it at all as illegal. The average person thinks that this is how it should be done. So I'm wondering, maybe it's more pervasive than that.
Well, I mean, this might take us down another path, but generally,
I would go to a local DVD store or CD store with a list of music that I want, hand it to the gentleman behind the counter. He would take €5 and give me back my DVD.
We've found very little ambiguity, or these scenes of piracy, in our work are not misunderstood, they're not widely misunderstood, and the main signal is price, right? People know what the illicit goods cost, and if they don't explicitly know it, they have a pretty good idea that if they're paying a fraction of that, it's a pirated good. We've found that people uniformly, you know, although some are happy to express sort of moral qualms about that, it's has no impact on the prevalence of the practice.
It's sort of like the social perceptions in the different countries.
We do quite a bit of that in the report. So you know, there's a whole angle that I haven't really sketched here on consumption practices. Right? So there are we've mapped out a kind of divergence of practices of consumption, where at the very high end, you're moving toward consumption that has a diminishing relationship to personal ownership, right? Media collections are becoming enormous to the point where people no longer actively manage them, people can't even adequately know them. Acts of acquisition are no longer strictly intentional acts. People have many more songs in their collection than they ever listened to. I mean, it's not clear the notion of the collector is no longer operative at the high end of the media consumption spectrum. It's not operative at the low end either, where you have access to low-cost recorded media for the first time at levels that billions of people can afford, not just hundreds of millions. So there you have practices of collective consumption that are related to the lower availability of screens and sort of personal viewing and less proprietary relationship to collections. So there's this middle space that's still sort of organized around the image of the collector that is, in our view, a kind of artifact of and a disappearing artifact of the era of recorded media on optical discs or on discs.
Outside of available income between particular countries and their level of piracy. I'm thinking back to that study, and I'm sure somebody here knows it, where if the country had a McDonald's, it hadn't had a civil war. Economist did this study. So that kind of correlation, that measure of development or level of development?
Well, I mean, there are correlations between GDP per capita and piracy, loosely. I'm not sure I can recollect, but they're different for different media. I mean, overall, if you combine all the, if you combine them, there's a loose correlation, but it's a fairly strong correlation, if I recall, for software and I'm not going to get it right, but if you break down the individual categories of piracy, some correlate and some don't. But if you add them together, which is how people tend to do it because they look at the IIPA studies, there's a loose correlation, which is predictable, and it's the basis of this universal business strategy in developing countries, where they're not going to lower prices. The business strategy is just to kind of wait it out and wait for rising incomes to slowly increase the size of the population that can purchase goods at Western prices. So what's pulling the rug out from under that, of course, is that prices of technology are dropping at a much faster rate, right? And the capacities for trading and sharing and copying and pirating are just they're increasingly ubiquitous even at the very low end of the income ladder.
Things having to do with urban dwellers and rural dwellers, things like that.
In terms of rates of piracy,
yeah.
We haven't really gotten that deep into the rates question. We didn't do much with regard to rates because we saw no way to measure it anymore. I mean, it's at one point the optical disc, or the at one point the sort of recorded media market was fairly contained to fairly clear production and distribution chain, and then retail outlets, and you could do things like measure the apparent turnover of pirated copies at a set of retail outlets. That's how the industry used to conduct their research in many countries, by observing retail outlets. Well, that's gone, right? It's not conspicuous.
Yeah.
The enforcement has, by and large, succeeded in breaking optical disc piracy at the retail level in many countries. So you see this process of deformalization of piracy, where it's no longer the small, the small storefront that's full of pirated DVDs. It's the street vendor. It's people who are much more mobile, who carry less stock, who are less vulnerable to raids or to enforcement. So the part of the enforcement process that's worked is the part directed against retail optical disc sales. That, with enough police raids, you can crush that. Of course, the impact of that is very unclear. I mean, one thing it does is it creates a massive reconfiguration of distribution at a lower level, at a much less formal level. So most of the figures around rates of piracy are still related to this sort of retail problem. And we just didn't see much to be gained by trying to refine how that's counted.
And those rates include solely stuff that companies are paying to track. So like in Brazil, they have a large music industry where they're like, just take it. So they're not saying like the percentage of music consumed in Brazil it doesn't include any of that stuff that's being given away for free and that is on a alternate business model that doesn't depend on license. They're just looking at their own stuff from like those losses and level charts. Those are just coming from like.
Well, I mean, the record industry is peculiar in that it relies on local affiliates to do all its local country research, but doesn't impose a standard template on those research methods. So it's really unclear what's being done, whether it's internally consistent, how it's cobbled together when the IFPI. Reports on piracy, how the RIAA then modifies that in order to come up with loss estimates. It's a black box.
Lack of
credibility. Is there like any preference for people to buy illegal copies of things to support the artist or for whatever reason, or if they just can't afford to do so?
There are lots of reasons why people still buy legal goods.
I mean, do people have a reason to do it other than for enforcement, other than fear of enforcement?
There's no fear of enforcement. Uh-huh. They do it entirely for other reasons. at the consumer level, enforcement just hasn't mattered. So, you know, we've documented lots of reasons why media markets are still growing in many countries. Because the CD market held up in South Africa until 2007. You know, it peaked in most other countries in 2004. There are lots of kind of odd consumer habits that dictate purchases rather than pirated copies. So we did some focus group work in Russia where, oddly, you know, it was fairly common sentiment that CDs or DVDs were very desirable gifts, and if you're giving a gift, you buy it. You don't pirate it. Well, you know, that's probably a very small share of the market, but it was, you know, a powerful enough rationale that it appeared in, you know, more than insignificant number of responses. In several of the countries we looked at, there are kind of homegrown, artist-driven enforcement campaigns in South Africa and Bolivia that try and capitalize on through patriotic desire to protect local cultural products from, you know, and to protect them preferentially within the pirate marketplace. Please.
I'm keeping you from getting. Are we keeping you from getting through your talk?
Well, I'm happy to continue this way and just kind of throw out a couple more things, but.
I have a question. when this report comes out, possibly in March, what will be the fair-minded person's takeaway? What are we going to learn at the highest level of generality and abstraction?
Well, there are a number of different audiences for the report. My goal throughout, I mean, obviously this is not a report that's going to be popular with industry lobbyists. It's a report that I hope will be perceived as true, fundamentally true, by industry researchers. So that's been one important target of the work to provide.
What would lobbyists like about it? Yeah. What's really going to hurt them?
Well, it departs from the theft narrative that has defined the debate. It's really written from the perspective of developing economies, where, you know, much of the reasons for the persistence of piracy and the ubiquity of piracy are just not part of the piracy debate as it exists in policy circles, strangely. So you never hear about pricing in discussions of enforcement. You never hear about the problems with the organization of the illicit market. And these are things that that, you know, if the goal, if your goal, and indeed as our goal, is to encourage developing countries to assert a bit more independence over their local IP policies and their local enforcement policies in the service of richer local media markets. So a rich legal formal media market is better than an impoverished informal pirate market. But how do you get there? And we don't see current industry practices as providing anything like an adequate answer to that. You know, the next 3 to 4 billion consumers are not going to be sold on $12 CDs, $15 DVDs, and $300 copies of Office. That's just not how that next wave of adoption is going to happen.
Is there any response that say, or is it simply over the enforcement and judicial side of it?
On pricing, in particular?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so pricing is not being taken, is not considered in these debates. Now it will be. I'm a developing country. I say, damn it, that's right. Is there anything I can do on the pricing side? Is there pressure that can be applied?
Well, again, it depends on the sector. One of the more interesting sides of this question has to do with business software piracy, where It's very clear what the industry strategy, what the industry market strategy is, and it's an area where I'm I continue to be a bit baffled by the representations of people within the software industry about how they do their work, because what they say they do and what the market actually does seem to be two entirely different things. And I haven't quite sorted out my own views about this cognitive dissonance, but basically the business software strategy in developing countries is to allow rampant piracy of their products, at least for companies that have platform products of different kinds, to ensure universal adoption. And then they begin to enforce against the most vulnerable institutions. So then they go after the municipal governments, schools, departments, large companies, small companies. They go after the fixed actors and begin to expand the pool of people who are roped into the legal licensed software economy.
To exempt the schools and municipal governments from enforcement?
They don't.
They want to sort of protect their own interest and say, well, these people are off limits for enforcement actions.
Well, I mean, they haven't. And the interesting question for me is, well, what's the place of open source strategies in this mix? And it's really a subject for further work. But my conclusion is that most governments have not demonstrated any consistent commitment to open source adoption, but the threat of a serious adoption strategy is an important tool in their negotiations with Microsoft and other and Adobe and a couple other companies. So these there are a lot of sort of half-baked open source adoption strategies in developing countries, but very few fully implemented ones. And that seems to be an adequate outcome for many of these developing country governments. That the important thing from their perspective is to have a rich, widely supported software infrastructure for as widely deployed as possible, and they have that with pirated copies of Windows and Office. And the incentive to switch to open source is too marginal to really prompt the kind of investments, that would overcome the transition costs. And so that I think is a real challenge for the open source community. I think they're being gamed in many instances by this kind of high level Microsoft strategy, which Microsoft, among other things, has been very successful in locking out open source from open source solutions from most developing economies. I think this is an optimal strategy for the software companies. I'm not sure they'd want it any other way. I don't know. Nobody at Microsoft would trade 95% penetration of the Chinese software market for strong, 10% stronger enforcement of licenses. It would just never. And people like Bill Gates have said this repeatedly. So you have this really odd dissonance between the way the software market is organized in developing countries and enforcement rhetoric. So in my view, that the BSA is very entrepreneurial, but it is sharply limited by the unwillingness of any of the major software companies to really rock the boat. Because if they came down and said, we are going to start enforcing Windows 7 licenses in China, and we're going to do it via online authentication or something, which they could do now, adoption of Linux would be overnight, right? Nobody's going to pay $200 licensing fees for for Windows 7. But with a 90% pirated base, they can start going after the companies, they can start going after the municipalities and say, well, it won't cost you 90, it'll cost you 50, but now you're part of the Microsoft software ecology. And that's how it works. I think that is their only possible strategy in these contexts. And it's been a very effective one. And they're still growing at 30%, so it's really not clear to me how they're suffering in any real extent, to any real extent from piracy.
Enforce its IP against Microsoft.
If you're an open source advocate, piracy is a real problem. That was actually my next slide, or one of my next slides. I'll just another note. We haven't found any significant connections between piracy and organized crime or terrorism. All right, this is an argument that circulates widely in the enforcement debates, and it's based on kind of selective misreading of the history of optical disc piracy. Back when Optical disk piracy was a profitable business. It attracted organized crime when it was a business based primarily on smuggling across borders. It, you know, had obvious connections to organized criminal networks smuggling other kinds of goods. That's just less and less relevant to how the pirate economy is structured these days. It's a vanish, you know, the diminishing profits associated with optical discs. They're being driven out of business by the non-commercial side of the pirate economy. Piracy obviously overlaps with criminal activity in different contexts. Poor neighborhoods, the informal economy. There's a spatial overlap. There are lots of little overlaps. We see no systematic overlaps. No reason to think that piracy is in any way systematically connected with harder forms of organized crime like drug trafficking, arms smuggling, human trafficking. That's fairly conclusive in our work, in my opinion. Software business I've just sketched for you, but these are some fairly iconic quotes. You know, you may have seen these before. And you see in the Romanian president's comment, the way he sees this is as part of a negotiation with piracy is part of a negotiation with Microsoft. It's part of their long-term relationship with Microsoft. This is not, this is not something that's it's practically part of an industrial policy at that point. And that's quite common, of course. You know, the history of piracy in different industrial contexts has been pretty well excavated at this point, and I won't go into it any length. But that is a default setting for development policy. You take the other guy's IP, you make it your own, you make use of it, and then you negotiate the deal that brings you back into the relationship later on. Trains the workforce. Yep.
A bunch of pirated Coldplay CDs out somewhere, or a bunch of pirated books out somewhere. Does that, have an impact on where they might tour? Are there any sorts of correlations that you guys found, or evidence that you saw that might actually help artists in some way, shape, or form, but not in terms of direct sales?
We see plenty of evidence that artists think so, and the boom in the performance market in the U.S. it's not limited to the U.S. It's a global boom. And there, we didn't get very far in tracking things like the impact of this on artistic livelihoods. We did do a survey of musicians' attitudes toward piracy, but in relation to pirated production software that they all use among musicians in South Africa. So, this is another category of good that is very high priced. If you're trying to buy it legally, many of the key tools are not easily available. All the musicians use pirated copies of, I'm not going to recollect the names, but.
We want to get a cap on the formal part of this.
Okay. Well, I can do that right now.
Great.
And come back to questions. So, these are also a couple of the iconic comments from industry leaders and lobbyists. So this is the hard line, right? Any form of uncontrolled distribution is illegal, and this has been the driver. These kinds of comments have really driven the debate for the last 20 years. As I indicated in some of my comments about industry research and the way industry research has changed, this context is changing. Mike Masnick described this recently as sort of a new phase. The industry's entered the bargaining phase of the five stages of grief, where there's a much more sophisticated account of what pirate markets look like and how they relate to licit distribution channels. That's beginning to emerge at the edges of the media economy, and I'm sure you're all familiar with examples of it. Low-cost streaming services. Very low-cost rental services. This is changing dramatically in the high-income countries. And a quote like this from Rob Bauer is, I think, a good example of it. Right, where piracy is no longer being a priori characterized as the opposite of what they're doing, but rather as a signal of market demand, unmet market demand. So that's quite important, and you know, one of the goals for this report is to encourage that kind of rethinking about what the structure of piracy is, how it relates to illicit legal markets. The concern in the report, I think the concern of really all the teams, is that the last place to reflect this kind of change in thinking is going to be U.S. policy toward developing countries, because it doesn't cost anything to maintain the hard line. It doesn't cost U.S. taxpayers anything. The modest benefits from ramping up enforcement in other countries are going to accrue to U.S. companies. The costs will all be in the other country. So this is really where we're hoping to push the debate really toward a more rapid accommodation of what I really see as new industry thinking into the policy space, and that'll be a significant accomplishment if we can contribute a little bit to it. That will really be a happy conclusion to this work for me.
What the a last question or two?
More thinking aloud, trying to take all this in, but to what extent does reformatting, like 3D movies or Blu-ray, is that an effort to preempt pirates by staying a step ahead of them? You can't get the same thing in a pirated version. You have to get the new thing. Or is that primarily about the American market?
No, it's very much a part of the gambit. I mean, what it does is it recreates scarce production. And recreates the conditions for a kind of smuggling-based pirate economy. So there are always going to be opportunities for that to reemerge. With respect to HD and Blu-ray stuff, it's of no significance in the markets we were looking at. I mean, it's just
people don't care if they don't see the Blu-ray version, or because they're getting Blu-ray pirates just as fast as they need to.
Well, I mean, nobody's getting. I mean, in 2004, 2005, you had the advent of $40 and $50 DVD players that were really that was the moment when the DVD infrastructure permitted mass piracy and really created demand for much larger quantities of DVDs. The Blu-ray's just not there yet because they're just not very widespread. The machines are not widespread. That'll happen, and then if you're trying to extrapolate from the trends with DVDs, the first version of that will be smuggling from East Asian and South Asian or Southeast Asian Blu-ray factories, right, where they're running. They're either completely illegal or, in the more common scenario, they're running 24 hours, and one of those shifts is devoted to pirate production. Right?
So I think we're going to have to take this as a first installment on this discussion. We look very much forward to seeing the report, and we'd like to thank you so much for joining us.